Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, we welcome now musician and writer James McBride. You may know him from his memoir, The Color of Water, about growing up half black, half Jewish in Jamaica, Queens. His most recent book, Song Yet Sung, is just out and connects a runaway slave in 1850 Maryland to modern-day critiques of hip-hop culture and America today in general. James McBride, welcome back to WNYC.
Glad to be back. Thank you for having me.
And I want you to get our listeners right into this book by asking you to read the first paragraph of Song Yet Sung, would you?
Okay. On a gray morning in March 1850, a colored slave named Liz Spocott dreamed of the future, and it was not pleasant. She dreamed of Negroes driving horseless carriages on shiny rubber wheels with music booming throughout, and fat black children who smoked odd-smelling cigars and walked around with pistols in their pockets and murder in their eyes. She dreamed of Negro women appearing as flickering images in powerfully lighted boxes that could be seen in sitting rooms far distant, and colored men dressed in garish costumes like children, playing odd sporting games and bragging like drunkards, every bit of pride, decency, and morality squeezed clean out of them.
So Liz Spocott's dream sounds like something from the website Hot Ghetto Mess.
Well, if that's one of the premises of the book, if a slave appeared now and saw how many black Americans were living, they'd be deeply disappointed.
So that's prompted some raised eyebrows, you know, that your book suggests that contemporary black culture is unworthy of the legacy of slaves' valiant struggle to be free. Do you go that far?
Well, whoever said that hasn't read the book. And secondly, what is hip hop culture? I mean, you know, that's a catchphrase that's really meaningless. It's like, what is jazz? Yeah, I mean, certain elements of hip hop culture that are great. The music that, you know, especially in the early life of hip hop culture was fantastic. But the bestiality, the homophobia, that kind of stuff is regressive business.
You said in an interview in Publishers Weekly, we've become the people we've dreaded, a consumer society. There used to be lines of people at church, and now that happens in Kmart, Costco, Walmart, and I'm as much a consumer as the next person. Then you said, we're all slaves to something.
Indeed, that's true. And also, you know, the moral bar of society, I mean, I don't want to sound like Bill Cosby, you know, please. But, I mean, the moral bar of society does seem to be slipping down.
So what's the difference between you and Bill Cosby in this respect?
That's a good question. You know, I'm always scared to come on your show because you really ask these really hard questions. Well, for one thing, you know, I mean, I happen to think that the critique of Bill Cosby toward, you know, black people and black parents is just completely unfair. I mean, you don't see Woody Allen critiquing, you know, Jewish parents about materialism in Jewish life or whatever. I mean, Bill Cosby happens to be a very successful entertainer. He's done a lot for the black community and so forth, but he's no one to quote. He's no expert on black life, and neither, frankly, is Alvin Poussin to talk about these people raising. They don't know what it's like to be a single parent now and to raise kids now. It's just unfair.
What gave you the idea to connect a slave narrative in 1850 to America today?
Well, there are a lot of similarities, unfortunately. I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, slavery was a web of relationships, and the web of relationships that connected whites and blacks is never really discussed in narrative or historical fiction. And in many ways, the connections between us as white and blacks is something that we either take for granted or we ignore. And so I basically just decided to explore that relationship between whites and blacks in a real way, as opposed to how it's presented in books like Gone with the Wind and so forth, you know.
And in the book, Kathleen is a white woman who has three slaves who write, quote, "She's known her four coloreds the better part of 15 years. They were, she felt, part of her family, and hers, she felt, was part of theirs. She could not imagine life without them. She believed that they, like her, understood that their collective survival made them dependent on each other, and that made her feel safe." Is that part of the interconnectedness that you're talking about,
or
a very
different
kind?
No, that is part of the interconnectedness. Of course, now her slaves felt differently about it. I mean, there was a dependency that they had on her as well because she took care of them. They didn't have to pay bills and so on and so forth. But there's a connected feeling that there's an interconnectedness between us today in America, between white and black and so forth, that we really we need each other. And we have to find ways to resolve our issues. And we have to deal with reason and discourse in terms of how we deal with each other. And slavery was no different in that regard. You couldn't really force slaves to do things. There were a lot of the relationships between masters and slaves were more like the relationships, you know, you and I would have with our gardener. Well, I'm sure you don't have a gardener living here.
No, not in a co-op apartment. But my guest is James McBride, whose new historical novel is called Song Yet Sung. Anybody want to call up and talk to James McBride, either about his writing or, for that matter, his music, if you're familiar with it, and also the issues that he's raising and discussing here. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. When we continue, I want to talk about one of the other things in the book, which is that, which is the code that you write about. This is part of the historical aspect of the book, the code that runaway slaves were supposed to speak in order to survive. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. My guest, James McBride, who you may know from his memoir, The Color of Water. His new book is a historical novel called Song Yet Sung, which connects a runaway slave in 1850 Maryland to modern-day America. She dreams of modern-day America. That must have scared her, huh?
Well, modern-day America is a scary place, I suppose.
She didn't know what it was, right?
Well, no, she didn't figure it out. She never really figures it out. I mean, she uses these dreams to help herself escape, but she can't quite make a lot of sense about what she sees.
So there is the contemporary cultural critique, but there's also the historical story, and it's a very dramatic story of this one woman's life, her connection to a slave capturer. The code, as I mentioned before the break, it's so interesting. Talk about the code and how much of that is historical and how much you made up.
Hard to say how much I made up. I mean, a lot of it. Well, first of all, in terms of a black American life, of African American history, when I studied music at the Auburn Conservatory, an African American music history course, one of the first things they teach you is that a lot of African American history is buried in its music. And these are songs that I sang in church, you know. Take me to the water to be baptized. We will break bread together on our knees, wade in the water. These were songs that were clearly used during the Underground Railroad to communicate between blacks and those who wanted to be free, and between slaves and those running the Underground Railroad. Some of the other stuff I'd gleaned from books and manuscripts and historians who talk about various codes that blacks use to get free. Mind you, Frederick Douglass, and I know historians talk about this, they get real crazy, you know. It was a big story about this in the New York Times. Some guy was yakking, you know, there were no codes, blah, blah, blah. How come our mythology is always challenged? I mean, you know, Jesse James, like, he shot an 11-year-old kid in the middle of Missouri because the kid happened to be in the way when he was robbing a bank. Yet, you know, they make movies about him and, you know, and how he was killed and how he was kind of a Robin Hood figure and so forth. So, I mean, basically, I just created what was real and put a little mythology to it and created a dramatic and, I hope, interesting story.
And in the author's note at the beginning of the book, or the end of the book, you talk about Harriet Tubman, who was born in Dorchester County, Maryland, which is where the novel is set. And there's that moment where, as you put it, you, quote, stepped into the cornfield and felt the vibes, unquote. Where were you in your life at that moment?
Well, I had just failed at writing another novel that just upped and died under its own weight. Thank you, Lord.
Is this your first published novel?
No, this is my second. My first one is called Miracle at St. Anna.
Oh, right. Actually, isn't Spike Lee making that into a movie?
Yeah, that's right. Spike is making that into a movie, yeah.
Congratulations.
Man, I'm on such a roll, it's not funny, man. I mean, thank you, Lord. You know?
When does that come out?
That comes out in November on Disney Touchstone Pictures. Spike did a wonderful job.
What was your role in the production?
I just wrote the screenplay and stood around.
Oh, you wrote the screenplay?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wrote it with Spike's help. And I basically stood around and watched him raise the money for it and do it. It was a fantastic experience.
I guess after you write a novel and then a screenplay, the standing around part must feel pretty good.
Well, look, you know, it's not every day you pick up your phone and Spike Lee's on the other, you know, on the other end saying, hey, you know. And he likes this book, too, as well.
Did anybody pitch that to him, or did he just read the book and say, that's a movie?
Listen, nobody paid attention to The Miracle at St. Anne. People didn't see me as a novelist until, like, now.
You were a memoirist.
I was a memoirist. I mean, Miracle at St. Anne, you know, Color of Water sold, like, you know, over 2 million copies or something. And Miracle at St. Anne, you know, it sold 8 copies, and I have 11 brothers and sisters. So, you know, no, I'm just kidding. It sold a lot of copies, but... you know, Spike read it, and he called me, and he said he wanted to make a movie about it, and he did it. And he did it, you know, he did it in his own way.
Color of Water was almost the official book of New York City, right? After Chicago read To Kill a Mockingbird, and there were discussion groups all over the city, they were looking for a book for New York to read, but it, in true New York style, it broke down into acrimony between your book and Cheng Rae Lee's book.
Well, God bless Cheng Rae Lee. I mean, you know, I think they selected his book in mind. We were a tie. You know, this is only in New York can like a black Jew and a Korean American be like a tie, you know?
Hey, Clinton and Obama.
Well, you know, I suppose so. That's one way of looking at it.
Keith in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with James McBride. Hi, Keith.
Yes, hello. I haven't read your book. It's the first time I've heard about it, but the premise is very interesting. But the question I have is that do you touch on, just the power of media and pop culture? Because, you know, even back then in the 1850s, if you look at, you know, pictures of, you know, black men, they were, you know, straightening their hair then, trying to look like the, their masters or just dominant culture. So it's something that you know, we always talk about these influences and you know, hip hop culture, but you know, there it sort of feeds on itself. Someone sees, you know, a hip hop guy on the cover of a magazine or on television, they hear they're making all this money, says, oh man, I want to do that, so I have to be even you know, more gangster, more hip hop, more dangerous, more sexual, and it feeds on itself.
James?
I don't know if you touch about that in the book.
Well, I don't go that deep into it. The book isn't really a treatise on hip hop culture. It basically deals with she has these dreams, and she shares these dreams with these other slaves with whom she's trapped. And her dreams galvanize them into a breakout and escaping. And then the book basically deals with the web of relationships that exist back then. On the Eastern Shore of Maryland, which was a place where a lot of really interesting things happened in terms of the slave trade and the watermen who lived there and the white slave owners and the whites who didn't own slaves and people being trapped within the whole business of slavery. I don't really get too deep into the whole business of the hip-hop culture, partly because there's no way that, you know, there's no way I could satisfy the craving to discuss that in the ways that you just so eloquently put it.
Keith, thank you for your call. Did the Eastern Shore of Maryland captivate you as the location for this book? Because, as one character put it, how can a colored be happy if freedom is only 80 miles away?
Well, that's it. I mean, I tried to place the story in Illinois first, and then Ohio, and it just didn't work. The Eastern Shore, Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman were born around the same time, within 25 miles of each other. And anyone who has ever seen the Eastern Shore, it's mostly water. In fact, nowadays, the historians are now starting to figure out that Harriet Tubman did a lot of her running of her Underground Railroad using watermen, both white and black watermen, who ran boats along these swamps and creeks. I mean, there are hundreds of swamps and creeks and rivers along the Eastern Shore of Maryland. So it was a great setting to set this story up.
Lily in Westchester, you're on WNYC with James McBride. Hi, Lily. Lily, do we have you? Maybe not. Let's try Arthur in Manhattan. Arthur, are you there? I think the callers can't hear me. Arthur, can you hear me? All right. Let me go back to the character Liz. This is the slave woman who is a runaway, but she doesn't want to ride the gospel train because she says there's no point. I'm going to read another paragraph from the book. She says, "You love the North. You love a place. There ain't nothing there to love. Not today, not tomorrow. You know what's up there? Colored men walking around free as birds. They don't love their women. They don't love their children. They love horseless carriages and money and boxes of candy, clothing, long cigarettes and chains, chains of gold. They cry for their chains. They even kill for them. Ain't nothing they won't do for them." So I guess she's conflating her vision of the future and freedom in the North in 1850.
Right. Well, she doesn't understand what she's seeing. She doesn't understand why they react to this behavior. Listen, look, if you were a Martian and you flew down to Earth and you saw men killing each other over tennis shoes, or for that matter, killing each other over oil or smoking a cigarette, you wouldn't know what to make of it. And so for her, it's just raw imagery that she's trying to translate into. She's trying to process in her own time, in her own way, while trying to run away and be free.
And the slave capturer in the book is a woman. Why did you make that person a woman? Wasn't it overwhelmingly men who tried to recapture the runaway slaves back then?
That's true, but Patty Cannon was a real woman. Patty Cannon actually lived in Reliance, Maryland, and she had her house right on the border between Delaware and Maryland, so that anytime the authorities went to arrest her, she could move into another room and be in another jurisdiction. She was a very feared slave stealer. And she was apparently very beautiful, ruthless, strong. She had a gang of men. She was a wonderful character to work with.
James McBride, my guest on WNYC. His new novel is called Song Yet Sung. And now I think we have Arthur on the line. Arthur, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hi.
The American Negro gave us jazz, soul, R&B, et cetera, et cetera. The African-American, would you tell me what he gave us other than hip-hop?
Well, I mean, I don't even know how to respond to that question other than to say that, you know, the American Negro and African-American, one and the same.
So I'm going to move on to Michal in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I love your show, Ben.
Thank you.
I think it's a really interesting topic, James, and I'm looking forward to read it. And I'm a psychotherapist. I work with diverse population, and a lot of my black patients, I'm white, I'm Israeli, and there are a lot of racial issues coming up. And a lot of my black patients, when they bring current racial issues and a lot of anger, and we try to work it through, they tell me, how do you expect me to work on anger that is 400 years old? And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about that, or if you have encountered something like that in your experience.
Well, first of all, I don't know how I don't know how you respond to that. I mean, the anger is not 400 years old. The anger is 15 years old or 17 years old, or however old they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know that that's the proper response to being maltreated in American society. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know what the response to
you
that
mean
is.
The anger is not an appropriate response?
Of course it's an appropriate response, but it's not the response that's going to lead them to be healthy individuals.
I'm curious, and you say you're a psychotherapist. I've heard this. We've done an interview, more than one, on the show with black psychotherapists who specifically talk about trying to deal with the sociology of African-American psychology.
Right.
And acknowledging the reality of the historical roots of some of the anger that feed into whatever the person's personal situation is. So what do you do as a psychotherapist?
Well, I think it really depends on the patient and their narrative, their life narrative. And I think it really depends how the therapist works, from what kind of orientation they come from. But I think if you really bring it into the room and talk about the relationship, the current relationship, and how it kind of manifested in that relationship, I think that's what is something that they can really take with them and look at.
Well, a couple things. One, if you want to continue this conversation, I'll be at Human Books tonight at 6 o'clock because we don't have a lot of time to talk about this on the air. But the second thing I'd like to say is that Well, I was once met a survivor of the Holocaust. She was the child of a Holocaust survivor. And we were driving across 125th Street. I was taking her to the airport. She was an Israeli woman. And I said to her, you know, how come you can't, you know, kind of get over it? Why don't you just get, you know, can't you get over this? I mean, I know your parents are Holocaust survivors. And she looked out the window and she pointed to 125th Street and she said, well, when did slavery end? And that kind of shut me up, you know. It really put it in perspective. So I think any black person who's not a little bit pissed off is probably a deeply disturbed person. But on the other hand, you have to learn how to deal with your anger and understand that the person that's sitting across the street, you know, across from you on the bus has nothing to do with your anger.
We just have two more minutes, and I will reinforce that James McBride will be reading tonight. He beat me to it at 6 p.m. at Human Books, 2319 Frederick Douglass Boulevard at 125th Street. We also have that posted on our show page. If you forget and want to know where and when, go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. You know, people know you primarily from The Color of Water, but when I looked at the flap of this book that has your bio, it says you're a musician and writer. Musician first.
Yeah, well, I mean, fledgling musician these days, nobody even knows. And when you think McBride, people think Christian McBride, as right. Well they should.
In the jazz world. What do you play? Where do you play it?
I play saxophone. I have, quintet. We play about 25 university dates a year. I wrote songs for Anita Baker and Grover Washington and people like that.
And in your author's note, you talk about how when you have writer's block, you have to go to a Holiday Inn. Does it have to be a Holiday Inn? A Motel 6 won't do?
Well, Holiday Inn, it smells so bad that you just want to get out so you get your work done, you know?
That's pretty funny. You want to talk for just a second? We have a minute left about music, you know, the stuff that you've written and where things are today.
Well,
what do you like?
I want to make it clear that I really enjoy hip-hop culture, and I think that there's a lot of great hip-hop music. I happen to think the elements of hip-hop culture, like the bestiality and the denigration of women, are just wasteful. Myself, I'm a jazz player. I played with Little Jimmy Scott for a couple of years, the jazz vocalist. I wrote songs for Anita Baker. I even was working in musical theater for a while here in New York, but I couldn't make any money at it. You know, I just couldn't succeed. You know, I wrote The Color of Water, and it just changed everything. So, you know, when the door opens, you walk out.
You have a black parent. You have a Jewish parent. Do you identify at all with Barack Obama more than anybody else for
Look,
that?
I mean, I don't want to turn people off from buying my book, but let's be straight. You know, I love Barack Obama. I think he's an important man. I think he ties right into the song yet sung in the sense that where are the, you know, you don't see Peru or Brazil or Great Britain floating up their black people or their people of color to be president. Only in America could that happen. And that's a great thing.
All right. James McBride, his new book is Song Yet Sung. Again, he'll be at the Human Bookstore reading tonight at 6 p.m. That's Frederick Douglass Boulevard and 125th Street. Always great to see you, James. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
I got shoes, yeah. You got shoes, Lord. All of God's children got shoes.
Don't you know that when I get to heaven, I'm gonna put on my shoes, I'm gonna walk all over God's heaven.
Yep, I'm going to heaven, glory, going to heaven. Everybody talking
about heaven, they ain't going to heaven.
Yep, I'm going to heaven, Lord,
I'm gonna walk.